Hey everybody, how's it going? Thanks for joining me this afternoon. I've got a great stream with a great guest that I think you're really going to enjoy. So Jeremy Carl is a senior fellow over at the Claremont Institute. He was part of the Trump administration. He's been on the show many times, but today I'm having him on because he has written a very important book that I think we need to talk about called The Unprotected Class. Jeremy, thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me, Oren.
Yeah, I know we've kind of hinted at this book in kind of our past conversations. You've been working on it for a long time, but I think it's really important to dedicate an episode to this because it's the kind of book that says something that I think most people probably look around and could recognize if they're honest with themselves, but no one is comfortable having a discussion about. And so while it's something that I think most people would rather not engage with, it's becoming more and more critical. And the fact that you went through and took the time and had the courage, frankly, to go ahead and put something like this together for people to take a look at and hear a calm, reasoned argument for why this is an issue and what can be done about it, I think is really important.
Yeah, well, thanks, Oren. And you know, we were just talking a little bit before the stream about theology and to kind of put it in religious terms, I kind of, in going through doing this book, it was a little bit like Jonah, you know, and God says, go to Nineveh and preach. And you're just like, you know, Nineveh, that's like a pretty powerful place. I'm not really sure I really want to go there and bother. And, you know, then he runs away, of course, and the fish swallows him and he spit back up. And the second time God tells him, he's like, well, yeah, okay, fine, I'll go to Nineveh. I had a little bit of experience where I've been thinking about this issue for years. I've kind of written around the edges of it. And God told me to go to Nineveh, and instead I moved to Montana, and I went into the Trump administration, and I did all sorts of things to kind of avoid writing this. But then, you know, at a certain point, you know, when I was in the Trump administration, a lot of my writings on this type of stuff attracted more attention from our enemies, and I just realized, you know, there's really no avoiding it. It's a really important issue, and I'm just, nobody else is writing this book, and so I'm going to.
Absolutely. Well, guys, we're going to dive into the substance of the book. I want to take us through the history, look at some of Jeremy's possible solutions. But before we get into all of that, let me tell you a little bit about ISI. Universities today aren't just neglecting real education. They're actively undermining it. And we can't let them get away with it. America was made for an educated and engaged citizenry. The Intercollegiate Studies Institute is here to help. ISI offers programs and opportunities for conservative students across the country. ISI understands that conservatives and right-of-center students feel isolated on college campuses and that you're often fighting for your own reputation, dignity, and future. Through ISI, you can learn about what Russell Kirk called the permanent things, the philosophical and political teachings that shaped and made Western civilization great. ISI offers many opportunities to jumpstart your career. They have fellowships at some of the nation's top conservative publications like National Review, The American Conservative, and The College Thinker. If you're a graduate student, ISI offers funding opportunities to sponsor the next great generation of college professors. Through ISI, you can work with conservative thinkers who are making a difference, thinkers like Chris Rufo, who currently has an ISI researcher helping him with his book. But perhaps most importantly, ISI offers college students a community of people that can help them grow. If you're a college student, ISI can help you start a student organization or a student newspaper or meet other like-minded students at their various conferences and events. ISI is here to educate the next generation of great Americans. To learn more, go to ISI.org. That's ISI.org. All right, Jeremy. So the subtitle of your book, The Unprotected Class, is How Anti-White Racism is Tearing America Apart. Now that phrase, just 5 years ago, if uttered by, I think, a mainstream political commentator, would have ended their career. It would have been salacious news. It would have created a firestorm in the media. This would have been something that's completely unsayable in any kind of company, especially a polite company. And the times seem to have changed through the efforts, I think, of several commentators who deserve credit, like Tucker Carlson and Matt Walsh and Charlie Kirk and many other mainstream people who maybe often aren't given credit for this by people who consider themselves more dissident right or online right or you know, somewhere. This is a phrase that has now entered, I think, at least to some extent, the popular consciousness. But still, when you talk to a lot of conservatives, especially older conservatives, people who are more of a Rush Limbaugh generation style conservative, this still rings hollow to them. It feels like a lot of times you try to have this conversation and they're like, this just isn't happening. That you're overblowing this. This sounds like something that a villain would say in a TV show from the 90s. And right. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that generational divide and how this has become something that some people are willing to address, but is still something that is many conservatives see as just a non-issue or something they're unwilling to engage with.
Well, Oren, you really hit on it, and it's sort of funny. When I was on Charlie Kirk's show a week or so ago, he actually brought this very thing up, and he said sort of, you know, when I talk with some of my older donors and such about this, they're like, oh, you know, you can't talk about this, it's racist or whatever. Whereas when I talk to younger people, and Charlie probably talks to more young people than just about any conservative commentator out there, they're like, oh, yeah, of course, you know, this is going on. So I think there's a couple things going on there, Oren. I mean, one of them is just the difference in experience, right? I mean, if you're old enough, you grew up in a time where our racial relations were very different. You also, depending on how old you were, lived through the civil rights movement and saw some of the things where America had sort of fallen short of its founding ideas before that. So, you know, you're kind of just coming at everything with a different perspective. And I also think you're kind of used to, if you're older, an environment in which the debate is just much more cut off. I mean, it's much more, there are these guardrails. You can't go outside the guardrails. And I think the younger people are kind of used to a freer discussion. And it's kind of funny, you know, when I've sort of gone on more dissident type programs to kind of discuss this, right? It's like, I'm kind of defending myself for, you know, having sold out or whatever, right? Because they want to, from their perspective, it's even more dire, the problem. It's even more hardcore. So, you know, what I've tried to do in this book is to make a case that on an issue that I know is a controversial issue, but I've tried to do it in a very responsible way, not kind of going beyond the facts. I've got almost 1,000 references in the book. And I think really it just, it's a res ipsa loquitur, the thing for it speaks for itself. And that's really what I've tried to do here.
Yeah, I really appreciate that you came at this. It's obviously a very divisive issue for a lot of people, but you came at this from a very, you know, it's not a polemic. It's not a flamethrower. You know, this is you laying out evidence in a pretty calm way, which is makes it something you can hand to somebody who otherwise probably would not engage with the subject, and they're not going to open this up and find a screed about all the injustice that's occurring, even though the facts are just laid out there. It's interesting because in many ways it feels like, you know, you're just kind of picking up free money off the ground. Like you're just picking up, you know, obvious, like this is just an obvious fact. I'm just laying out the details here anyway. Right. But then you realize the reason all of this was laying on the ground is no one wanted to touch it. Like that's why it's so easy to collect.
Right. No, I think you're right, Oren. And I think maybe I haven't said this before on a podcast, but honestly, maybe if I were more brilliant, I wouldn't have written this book, because I could just, you know, take some really hard esoteric thing and say something brilliant about it. I mean, I think I'm looking forward to reading your book, Oren. I think maybe you've done some version of that, and maybe it's just like I'm not bright enough, so like I'm just like, huh, this shiny thing is like right on the ground and it seems kind of important, and all I have to do is be brave. You know, I don't need to be like the most, you know, brilliant 7 degrees, talk about 15 Greek philosophers and give a powerful critique of Nietzsche versus Rawls, you know, to kind of explain like what's going on here. It's like, huh, white people are being discriminated against. Maybe we should talk about that. That's like the theoretical background that is necessary here. And so I really was, in some sense, as long as I was willing to stick my neck out, picking up free money on this issue. And, you know, I think it's just, it is something that we're beginning to talk about more. And again, you're certainly among those, Oren, who's been out there kind of pushing this type of issue to a broader audience. And I think it's really great. And I think the dialogue on this and the Overton window is beginning to move.
Well, certainly don't sell yourself short. I think you did an excellent job with this. It's very eloquently put together. So don't belittle the effort here for sure. And the courage in and of itself is much better than eloquence. That is a far more admirable trait than any other. So don't undersell that. But I want to approach some just basic questions here, because I think a lot of people watching this show are going to be familiar with why this is an important topic. This is not the first time they've heard this broach, so you probably don't have to pitch why this is happening. But if they're like me, they've heard a lot of arguments, they've been in basic conversations with people who just brush this off and, you know, can't see how it could possibly be an issue. And so I'm going to ask some things that seem rather obvious, but it's just nice to have them, you know, expounded upon in a way that I think the average person can go ahead and take to someone who they're trying to show this to and say, hey, this is an important issue. So I think the first thing that people look at, you know, beyond like, oh, this isn't really happening, you know, the next thing they'll say is, well, how could this possibly happen in a country that is majority white? I mean, come on, all the people in power are white. Even the people who seem to be pushing this are white in a lot of instances. How could this possibly develop in a nation that is majority the population that is supposed to be oppressed in this scenario?
Yeah. And I'd say a few things, and I just actually want to go back a little bit before I do this to something that you said in your last question, which is in terms of the audience for this. I think the most online edgelordy type people, if I can use internet terminology, will still read this book, even if they're pretty immersed in these issues, and learn a lot of things. But I also read it very explicitly for that mainstream audience. That person could go give it to their mom or their dad or their sister or whatever, or even their kid, who might be more skeptical, or like, and there's nothing in there that's going to scare them, or they'll feel like the argument is irresponsible, or, you know, I'm using a bunch of rhetorical flourishes. I'm actually not trying to play the oppression Olympics. You kind of used the term oppressed. I mean, I think there's still a lot of internally very functional things in the white American community. There's obviously a lot of history that we can point back to and other things like that. I'm not kind of looking to complain to the refs here. I'm sort of trying to rally the troops and say, hey, look, we don't need to put up with being treated in a second class fashion. So as to why this is happening, I don't have a neat answer. I'll give you a few kind of different things that I think are going on, because I think it's multifactorial. The first thing I think that we see really going on is, to the extent that liberal whites are driving this, and I actually would argue they're the kind of most powerful group, at some level, it's a kind of way of showing their alleged superiority, right? It's like, if you have so much money and so much power that you'll be fine and your kids will be fine, even if you're being discriminated against, that's kind of a flex, to use the kind of younger term, right? And so there's an element of that. There's an element to which those white people kind of see themselves as different and better than other white people. And if you spent time, I mean, I spent many years in Ivy League universities and similar type dynamics, so I'm kind of aware of that type of thinking being out there. I think it's that, for understandable historical reasons and other things, white solidarity of any type has always been very frowned upon and stigmatized in American culture. So, you know, right now, whites are about 58% of the population, but in no sense are they unified, let alone on this issue. Whereas I think, to a greater degree, minorities being unified is not stigmatized in this country. And so you're seeing a lot of those loud voices among minority community leadership combining with liberal whites. And that's what's kind of, I think, the primary drivers of this phenomenon.
So the other thing that you hear, I think, you know, and we'll talk about the evidence here in a second, but I wanted to get these questions out of the way first. I think once you lay out the evidence for a lot of this stuff, and you do in quite a bit of detail in the book, once people start seeing this evidence, the next response is almost always, well, maybe it's necessary. You know, maybe this is simply what it takes to redress the wrongs that were visited upon minority populations by a majority white population at some time in history. And, you know, if we aren't vigilant and we don't keep this, in place, then, you know, these things will reemerge, right? This is always the Joe Biden, he's going to put you all back in chains,
right,
moment on a regular basis. What would you say to those who say, look, like, you know, white young male, he's going to be fine, don't worry about it. Right. You know, at the end of the day, we have to do this to make sure that we kind of keep a certain level of social, cohesion, because we can't let these groups get elevated beyond each other.
Right. Well, I'd say a few things. I mean, one, Thomas Sowell, who is something of a touchstone for this book, talks about the quest for cosmic justice almost invariably leading to greater injustice. And I think that's absolutely true, right? So I kind of don't like that type of thinking about cosmic justice. But I'd say beyond that, a lot of these things that talk about how everything's so great for white people, to the extent that it was really true anytime in recent history, are kind of working on a lot of outdated information. We're seeing a lot of what the Nobel Prize winning economist at Princeton, Angus Deaton, and his wife Anne Case called Deaths of Despair, which I talk about in my book, among middle and working class whites of middle aged, drugs, suicide, other things. We're seeing a big increase among that in the white population, where their baseline, by the way, was also higher to begin with. And we're not seeing a comparable rise in other populations. Beyond that, a lot of these things that kind of point out, oh, how great it is for white people, sort of play a little sleight of hand where they erase, in particular, Asian Americans. And on pretty much any metric of income, education, health, Asian Americans are doing better than white Americans. And it's really hard to kind of have a white supremacist theory that incorporates that really neatly. I mean, the model minority stuff doesn't really fly for lots of reasons. But I point out it's not even just related to Asian Americans. I talk in the book about any number of groups like Venezuelan Americans or Nigerian Americans of Igbo descent and all sorts of other people who also are kind of doing better on pretty much any metric that you would look than the average white American. And so if you think that there's something systemically racist against these groups going on in our society, it's a little difficult to explain why we'd be seeing the sorts of things that we're seeing.
Yeah, I want to go ahead and get into the mechanisms, because obviously if this is occurring, then it has to be enshrined somewhere in the systems of our government or our wider culture. So I want to get into that, guys. But before we do, let me tell you about your moral duty to go ahead and hire based people through New Founding. Hey guys, I need to talk to you about New Founding. Look, we all know that the job market is a disaster right now. Based people can't find good companies to work for, and good companies can't find employees to get the work done. And that's why you need access to the New Founding Network. New Founding has created a network of high excellence professionals who are seeking to join grounded American businesses. They're individuals, often in elite organizations, who are ready for a team and mission that supports their values instead of working against them. Aligned companies are already using the network to hire high-trust, exceptional individuals who match the culture and mission of their team. You can apply for access to the New Founding Talent Network at newfounding.com/talent. You'll be connected with candidates who will build your business. That's newfounding.com/talent. Go there now to find your next hire. All right. So obviously the word systemic racism gets thrown around all over the place. We're very familiar with this at this point. And whenever someone gets asked, someone on the left alleges that there's still racism in the country, that that the average minority is held down, by the system, the first thing a conservative asks is, show me the racist law, right? Like, show me the evidence of where the legal code, where hiring policies, where you are allowed to actively and openly discriminate against, a minority in any of these parts of American life. And I think for a lot of people, if they hear the same thing about, the way anti-white racism, they're going to want to see the same evidence. So what would be some of the mechanisms that you point to in the book that would show people, hey, this is something that's actually encoded into our law, or this is encoded into the way that we have to do business in the United States that ensures that white people are treated with some kind of disadvantage?
Yeah, well, there's a few things, and one of them is civil rights law, and this is an area that's been covered by folks like my Claremont colleague Christopher Caldwell and Richard Hanania and Chris Rufo and some others, and I think that's really important. I actually spent a whole chapter in the book talking about it. I do think sometimes it's actually slightly overstated. This would be a slight degree of departure, I think, of my analysis from some of these other folks, and that I think if you eliminated every single one of those civil rights laws, it would be a necessary precondition to kind of and replacing them, or I shouldn't say eliminate, but at least amending them in some fundamental ways. It would be a necessary precondition to kind of fixing the problem, but it's not sufficient, right? And so you can kind of look at a state like California, which has twice banned affirmative action by popular referendum in the last 20 years in its universities. And yet if you go in these universities, that's kind of ignored. So, but civil rights is really important, and particularly things like disparate impact. And that may be kind of a phrase that's known to some of your more knowledgeable listeners and viewers, but for those who don't know it, I mean, disparate impact is a element of civil rights law that grows out of the 1971 court decision that I've written about called Griggs versus Duke Power. And it basically, to kind of oversimplify, if you're a business and you kind of have a outcome for an employment process, you know, a hiring process that is kind of varies significantly by race, it's said to have a disparate impact on the race affected, and you have to kind of jump through all these hoops to show that there was kind of a business necessity or some other thing that really justified that. And so what in fact businesses do, because they don't want to wind up in court, is they end up discriminating against white people to make sure that they don't have it. And by the way, the really key part of the Supreme Court ruling is the Supreme Court said in Griggs versus Duke Power, it doesn't matter whether you were intending to discriminate by race or not. And so in fact, what we just saw literally this week with a chain of convenience stores, I'm just blanking on its name all of a sudden, but they are being sued because they had criminal background checks for their employees. And that, because of the different rates of criminal offending by race, was seen as racially discriminatory. So that's kind of the level of absurdity that we're talking about that really is baked into the cake. And then before I kind of turn it back to you, I'll kind of point out one of the ways, okay, so that's the theory, you know, how do you see this in practice, is on our censuses, on everything else, there is a flight from white. And you see increasingly people doing everything they can to identify themselves officially and legally as something other than white, you know, whether that be that they're 164th Cherokee, and cue the Elizabeth Warren jokes here, or they're multiracial in some way or whatever. I mean, if they can seize on something other than being white, they are going to do that. And that is very consistent with the thesis that I'm telling in my book.
Yeah, I just wrote a piece that ran in the Blaze today about that convenience store chain. But
Sheets, right?
Yeah, Sheets, yeah. Yeah. So for all the additional jokes you get to make there. Like you said, I think civil rights is critical. But I think you're also right to point out that if you repealed it tomorrow, that doesn't mean that there would be a significant change. Curtis Yarvin made the point in his recent debate with Chris Rufo that what are you going to do? Make a law against being racist to white people? We have one. It's called the Civil Rights Act.
Right.
And so that in and itself is not enough. But people, I think, are more familiar with that, like you said, due to Christopher Caldwell's book and the focus that myself and others have brought to that. What are some other mechanisms that aren't just, I mean, they might be connected to civil rights law, but what are some other factors that have significantly changed the dynamics inside, you know, the racial dynamics inside the United States, or the increased the salience that has now inside different organizations, institutions?
Sure. And I think the interesting thing here is some of it is very formal in the ways that we were just talking about, and some of it is very informal. And in fact, one of the things I wrestled with before I decided to really go with the harder core term racism on the front is that of the book is, you know, some of it is discriminatory. Is it per se racist? You know, you can kind of have a debate about it, right? But there are some things that are kind of racist. There are some things that are functionally discriminatory, but they may not technically have racist intent. There are some things that are just changing about the culture. So I think there's a few things that have driven this. One, the complete demographic revolution we have had in America in the wake of the Hart-Celler Immigration Bill of 1965. So immigration, I'm not an expert. There's sort of 11 different subject matter chapters from business to Hollywood to academia, et cetera, that I talk about crime in this book. I'm not experts on all of them, but immigration is one where I do feel like I have a fair bit of expertise, and I write a lot about it in the book. So very few people kind of really understand the story of American immigration policy, but basically Hartzeller in 1965 is a dramatic departure from anything we've done before in terms of immigration policy. And it leads to a, kind of a replacement, if I can use the provocative word, of the old American demographics with new demographics. And so I think just a change in the numbers has played a role here. But also just things that are harder to quantify. Like in my Hollywood chapter, I talk a lot about, even starting in the 1960s, liberal scholars, mind you, who have kind of done the analysis, find that minorities were portrayed more positively than white people on average in Hollywood. Now, of course, this doesn't mean there weren't stereotypes or negative portrayals, but just this is what they find on average. And in fact, this has become such a cliche on in Madison Avenue in commercials. There's actually a Twitter feed that I believe is called White People Are Stupid in Commercials. I have it in the book, but it's literally just dedicated to the constant refrain in a contemporary commercial of the dumb white guy who is saved by the minority who's wiser, usually a minority female, even better. Again, this is so prevalent at this point, and it's not due to any law. It's due to a change in culture that again, you have entire advertising industry blogs and Twitter feeds and whatnot that are kind of devoted to examining this as a phenomenon.
Yeah, when white people are even allowed to exist in a in an advertisement, I think there's some comedian who made the joke of like, you know, in 20 years people are going to ask what apocalypse occurred to wipe all the white people out of advertisement.
Right.
Yeah. I think you're right to point out the importance of the cultural shift as well, and that's a lot harder to nail down because, of course, you don't have official laws and and things that you can point to and say this act of this date kind of introduces this, but I think it's critical. I mean, there's often a debate among, and in many of the circles that I'm in, whether law drives culture or culture drives law. And of course, the answer is a mix of both, to be sure. But I wonder what you think really drove the cultural end of this, because obviously people will look at the 1950s and however you feel about the shifts that occurred after, they'll say that this is a nation in which it seems like it's okay to be white. This is not a problem. This is not something that is a moral deficit on your part. But that seems to shift pretty noticeably as time goes on. And do you think that is something that's downstream from the immigration, from the narratives that are told due to the civil rights movement, to the law? Or do you think that this is something that is truly organic and has roots in kind of America's consciousness as it shifts into this kind of multiracial existence?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And it's funny, you just mentioned the phrase, it's okay to be white. And that was actually the original title I had for the book, which would, to say the least, be a provocative title. But it's actually interesting. I think the whole saga I had around that title actually really illustrates my thesis, in that this was a title, and for those of you who are sort of more online, who are listening to this, may recognize it. I don't know, maybe a decade or so ago, maybe a little less. These signs, kind of inspired by 4chan, which is an internet message board, began appearing particularly in college towns, and they just said, "It's okay to be white." Nothing else. There was no call to action. There was nothing else. And predictably, what ensued was a kind of firestorm, and all the diversity people at these universities denouncing them, and everybody saying racist and white supremacy, and then folks like Tucker Carlson kind of got in and said, is it not okay to be white? I mean, it's okay to be Asian. It's okay to be Black. It's okay to be Hispanic. It should also be okay to be white. But yet to even say that was seen as beyond the pale. So anyway, I got that title by my editorial team, but ultimately the sales team was like, I can't sell that title into Costco, right?
Well, to be fair, a guy in Britain has been arrested for making stickers with that. So your book might have actually been illegal internationally.
Right. And yeah. So this, I mean, to me, nothing could illustrate sort of better the actual reality of where we are, that this would be seen as some sort of outrageous provocation, right? So there is that's going on there. I think demographics again play a huge role, the changing demographics in Hard Seller. And again, I mean, I'm kind of just not a fan of diversity generally, and I want to say this very carefully so that it's not misconstrued. Does not mean that I am not fan of diverse groups of Americans, right? Like most people who've, I mean, I live in Montana now, but I've lived in very, very diverse areas. I lived in the Bay Area for many years, San Francisco Bay Area. I mean, I have lots of diverse groups of friends, colleagues, et cetera. The problem is that when you have diversity in any society in excess, that often leads to a lot of social conflict. It just does. I mean, this is a reality of diversity. It's not kind of incumbent upon any particular group in America. And so what happens is you get these groups, they're coming in, they're saying, wow, you know, I don't really seem to be, my ancestors don't really seem to be much of a part of this American story, for example, right? Like the founders at the founding, as best we could tell, the US citizen population wasn't just overwhelmingly white. It was about 85% British, right? So
like, I'm sorry, I've seen Hamilton. That can't be true. Yeah.
Well, so I talk about Hamilton in the book, right? Yeah. And this is actually fascinating. So I'll get to that in just a second. But they understandably, and again, this is not because they're bad people or evil people or they are malicious. They're like, you know, hey, I want to see, you know, my story told there, my ancestors' story. And so what do I need to do that? I need to delegitimize the earlier story. I need to tear down those statues. I need to say that it was systemically racist or white supremacist or what have you. And so these sorts of things are just inevitable. And I talk about Hamilton, which is actually fascinating to me. Hamilton, the Broadway musical, many of your listeners are probably familiar with, because it's actually a kind of classic intermediate product of what's the so-called Great Awakening, when all this racial stuff really begins to come off the rails in the early 2010s. And that it was started a little bit before then, and it's kind of concluded after that in terms of the writing. And I think ideologically it really reflects that, and that in some ways it kind of calls back to this very good civic nationalism. I mean, it valorizes for the most part the founders, even, you know, the slaveholding George Washington. It certainly valorizes Hamilton. And it kind of is telling a story that's proud to be American. So at one level you'd say that's good, and they're bringing in these different groups. But for those of you who are familiar with the story, you're familiar that the very intentionally there was color conscious casting ultimately of this show. And pretty much everyone's a minority, mostly African-American, although not exclusively. Lin-Manuel Miranda, who plays Hamilton, is Hispanic. You know, there's a couple Asian Americans. The one villain, King George, is white. And right. That is probably not a coincidence. And again, I think I'm not here to bash Hamilton. I actually think artistically it's very, very well done. I'm not going to here to bash it. I understand why it was such a successful production. I think Lin-Manuel Miranda is a very talented artist, but there is this ideological kind of substructure underneath it that, while it has some things that would unify us, really, when you kind of look under the hood, begins to tell a very disquieting story in which the whiteness of America's history and our founders is erased and a different story is told.
Yeah, I mean, it really creates an uncomfortable conversation, but it's one that's increasingly difficult to have when you have a diverse society and people, like you say, want to see themselves reflected in the world around them. You have to change the world that's around them to make that true. You have to change the history. You have to change the entertainment. You have to strip out many of the things that made the place what it is. And you have to, and it's, you know, very difficult then to acknowledge that that will have a inverse impact on the people who were the majority. You know, people right. always talk about representation, how important it is for minorities to have representation. Okay, well, what happens when the people who were the majority of the culture stop being represented? Like, what does yeah. that actually look like? And again, that's very scary, because that means people owe consciousness. There's a thing we have to notice, a thing we have to, but you can't have any of these conversations. And I feel like that's the difficulty that many conservatives are trying to do. They're trying to have this conversation with only one side of the conversation allowed to be said. And right. they're just screaming like, no, just ignore the other side. You can't, whatever you do, there's the one, what it's the one place we cannot go, to make a Dune reference. Like, it's the one right. place you cannot view. And so like, you're always in this extremely, you know, unproductive mode of conversation where there's an obvious answer to this question, but you're never allowed to invoke it, because if you do, everything explodes, and this just makes the problem unsolvable, especially for the right.
Absolutely. And I think you see this in a lot of the way that this kind of debate takes place publicly. You see white people's discomfort in kind of dealing with this issue at all. And what I'm kind of trying to say in the book is we need to kind of get over that, because if we're interested, and by the way, you can have, I mean, I sort of, one of the things I call for in the book is effectively what one might call multiracial whiteness. I borrow the term white shifting from scholar named Eric Kaufman, who's himself multi-ethnic and is Canadian, but he teaches in the UK. But he kind of wrote a book about kind of how he sort of sees a future in sort of creating a new, the sort of maybe less threatening way to talk about it for some people would be to say a scholarly term called ethnogenesis, right? That you're creating a new American ethnicity that may have its roots in a kind of European people and European culture, but is inclusive of groups like Hispanics, which are primarily European ancestry group anyway, or other multiracial people, or even monoracial people who just really want to identify with America's culture and history. And kind of a white pill, if you will, amidst all of this, is that you can actually, with the right kind of governmental and cultural backing of this, you can actually go quite a far way with this. And my favorite example of it is my friend Razib Khan, who's a kind of very well-known popular writer on genetics, has written about the Hungarians. And the Hungarians have this deep cultural referent in their history to kind of being descended from these Central Asian conquerors who kind of swoop in. And this is very much part of the Hungarian identity. It's even the reason a Hungarian language is totally different than all the other countries around them. Now, the reality is, overwhelmingly, all those Central Asian conquerors who swept into Hungary made up the nobility. They were all slaughtered in like the 14th century versus the Turks. I'm sure some historian will say I got the history wrong, but like that's roughly what happens. And so when you look genetically, you know, from a racial angle, the Hungarians basically represent nothing, a population that is extraordinarily similar to every other European population around it. But culturally, they feel this great affinity toward this Central Asian ancestry. So like, that's the kind of trick. I mean, that's not gonna happen to white people in the US anyway, but the point is saying that these things are malleable to a degree, you know, who we choose to identify with, but we've gotta actually be trying to move in that direction as opposed to what we're doing, which is toward more and more cultural disintegration.
So Jeremy Carl, Castizo futurism here is advocating.
It is absolutely Castizo futurism.
Yeah. All right. So a couple more questions here. Obviously, the next thing most people will want to know is, what's the point of all this, right? Like, where is this going? You can say that they're, you know, deploying this against, you know, the majority of the population, but that seems like a doomed project, right? Like, that's going to be demoralizing, or that's going to tear the country apart. Like, what would be the actual outcome here? What is the goal by implementing this system?
Well, and I say in the book that this is kind of a necessarily speculative exercise, right, to kind of discuss what people's motivations are, which are always multifactorial in any event. But what I kind of argue, and it's funny because as I've shared this with a few people on air, they've been like, oh yeah, of course, that's what I think it is too. So I basically say, look, like many, if not most arguments in politics, this is ultimately about the control of resources. And there is a perception and to some degree a reality that white people have a lot of resources. I mean, they were essentially the kind of historical American nation that kind of had everything up until the 1960s. So they've got resources. Other groups would like access to those resources. But in, you know, 2024 America, you can't just go up and say, you know, I want your stuff, right? Like, nobody's going to find that particularly persuasive. So you need what the mid-20th century sociologist C. Wright Mills called a legitimating ideology, which is to say that you need to create an ideology around this sort of issue that justifies actually, yeah, I'm going to take your stuff and it's really good because, by the way, you're systemically racist and you have white privilege and you're still discriminating against me and all these other things that are going to demand that it is actually in the interest of justice for me to take the things that used to belong to you. And so I think that is ultimately what we're seeing in things like reparations, in kind of all these discussions around privilege, in some of the social programs that are getting advocated for. That is really kind of the ultimate driver. It's kind of putting a pretty face on a kind of classical friend-enemy problem in politics. And I know you're very familiar, having written about these type of politics.
So we've already talked about the multiracial whiteness aspect of possible solutions. Are there any other ways, you know, to go ahead and remedy this? Are there any ways forward sure. can kind of bring peace and outside of just the one you've already discussed?
Yeah, and in no way am I saying I don't want to understate the gravity of our problems. I think they're very severe, but in no way are they unsolvable. And even for people who say, oh, they've never been worse, you know, if you look at the prelude to the Civil War, or even times in the early 20th century, we had a tremendous amount of social disintegration. Even though I think it's quite high right now, it was even greater at times then, or even parts of the 1960s with all these public bombings, you know, going on and whatnot. So I think there's lots of ways that we can solve it if we choose to reverse course. So we've talked a little bit about multiracial whiteness. We've talked about fundamental reform of civil rights laws. I think you particularly have to go after affirmative action. The court has now given us an opening to do that by declaring it forbidden in the context of university admissions. I think a really key thing is from the category of if you're in a big hole, stop digging. We need to basically move to a net zero immigration over a short period of time. That doesn't mean nobody's coming in, but it means that we're deporting an illegal for any legal person that is coming in. And we need a breather at the very least, where we can begin to reassimilate these groups and figure out what is this new American people and new American culture going to look like. Interestingly, the 1950s, which we were alluding to before, kind of something of an almost cliched heyday of this all-American identity. Even among groups, by the way, people say, but that was before civil rights. African-Americans are making tremendous, tremendous gains during this period. And in fact, in many ways, they sort of level off after the Civil Rights Revolution, which is something not a lot of people talk about. But this time of kind of almost stereotypical national unity, I don't think it's any coincidence that this happens in the wake of the 1924 Johnson-Reed Act, which is the strictest American immigration law that we've ever had, and really does begin to bring down the numbers and also lessen the diversity quite a bit in terms of sources of immigration. And it's doing over that over the next 30 years in which Italians and Poles and Jews and, you know, whoever else, they all kind of, I don't want to say melting pot because that brings up a whole other discussion, but they begin to Americanize, for lack of a better term. You know, they begin to adopt a common culture. And so I think all these things we can do. I think there's all sorts of alliances with groups like Asian Americans, who I think are kind of going to run. They're kind of the scapegoating whitey bit is kind of running out of room for them. It's just not going to really be viable. The sorts of ways in which white people are being discriminated against in the United States, many of them also apply to Asian Americans. And so I think there are opportunities for alliances there. So I think there's lots of things. I have 12 different kind of ideas in my book that I discuss in the concluding chapter, but in no way would I say it's a hopeless situation. It's just one that we need to get much more serious than we are about solving it. And, you know, I wrote this book because the first step of solving the problem is acknowledging that you have a problem. And so this is an attempt to really say, hey, this is a problem. Let's do something about it.
So one more question before we go to the questions of the people. On current events, right now, Columbia University is under siege, right? We've got one of our every like 6 or 7 years, an American university has to have some kind of, you know, insane communist protest. And this one, of course, is surrounding the issue of kind of what's happening in Gaza right now. And one thing we've seen is that, you know, the campuses, which have been very happy to host large number of speakers and demonstrations and sometimes outright, you know, violence in the name of kind of anti-white, anti-European sentiments, suddenly seem to have the need to crack down on these demonstrations, right? All of a sudden, the narratives that it applied to people of European descent when it comes to colonization and these kind of things were also being applied to Jewish Americans. And this seemed to spring people into action in a way that they hadn't really felt the necessity for action in, you know, the last decade of many of the things that you talk about in the book. And so I just wonder, do you think that the shift in attitude, the fact that it seems like Jewish Americans may now be treated more as white colonizers in the same narratives might apply to them. Do you think that might shift a group that has, for the most part, been a pretty stalwart supporters of the Democratic Party, open immigration of these things? Will that change their support of many of these? Or is that something where you just kind of have this monolithic support that exists for many communities like the Black community that don't seem to shift when material conditions or political conditions actually seem to change?
Yeah, well, I think we often hear this, this is going to be the prelude to the shift, and then the shift has not maybe happened the degree that we do think. I do think, however, that the current situation, Jews have always been perceived as white by U.S. law. It's something I talk briefly about in the book. But I think the segment of left-wing Jews who would like to run away from that, again, they're just increasingly running out of room. People are not going to play that game. And therefore, you do have a group that's been very influential and effective overall, and certainly is very disproportionately represented in environments like elite universities, that may, you know, finally be saying, hey, you know, we're going to come and play on the other team right now, because the team that we've been on does not really seem to be working very well for our interests. And I think that that has some risk, but it also has some very exciting possibilities for us if we are able to kind of effectuate that type of a shift. But, you know, they're also, and I think they're really, you're seeing people who are kind of making that shift in real time, but there's also resistance. And I just kind of think back when some of these things were going on at Yale, I got a note from a Jewish classmate of mine, and they essentially wanted me to sign some petition that effectively with kind of over, they wanted to like put Jews in the DEI category so they would get their own DEI things. And I'm like, no, I'm not doing that. Because I'm not, you know, what we have to do is tear this out root and branch, period, right? Like, I'm not making a separate piece for any group here. And so I think some people in the Jewish community are getting that, others are not. And I think over time, most of them are actually going to end up aligning with us on this, but it's going to be a process. And I think like lots of other groups, we're seeing under Trump, a lot of alliances shifting, whether it be working class Hispanics really migrating toward the GOP. There's a lot of political ferment and realignment in American politics right now, and this is just one piece of it.
All right, guys. Well, we're going to go ahead and go to the questions of the people. But of course, you absolutely should be going out, picking up Jeremy's book, reading it, checking out his work. Jeremy, what's the best place for people to pick up the book, find your other work?
Sure. So you can order it pretty much now on your retail store should be able to get it. But the easiest way, probably just go on Amazon or Barnes and Noble and buy it there. Again, it came out yesterday. It's been a great success so far. We're actually already doing a second printing, so that's been really exciting to me. Lots of endorsements from anybody to Tucker Carlson, Victor Davis Hanson, Charlie Kirk. You know, a whole host of Heather McDonald, you know, a whole host of kind of very big names on the right have been kind enough to lend their support to it. So you can certainly go do that. And to kind of make my small pitch beyond that, I would say if any of you understand the economics of book publishing, believe me, I'm not going to get rich or even make a significant amount of money at all off your purchase. But what it does do is it sends a message to publishers, and it was a risk for a mainstream conservative publisher, Regnery, the biggest and oldest conservative publisher, to take this book on. It was a risk, and the way that you tell them that there's a real audience for it is you buy the book, and then they're like, you know, people really care about this issue. People want to read about this issue. And so I think even if you don't think my solutions are perfect in buying the book, you're encouraging other people to sort of come forward. So that's one place you can find me. The other place you can find me is on my X/Twitter feed. That's Real Jeremy Carl. And I have a new Substack called The Course of Empire. And that's at jeremycarl.substack.com. And you can sign up there. It's free. And I roughly weekly just kind of give updates on what I'm doing. And you'll see pointers to my work. And I publish in a lot of different places. And if you follow me on both those places, you will not miss a single minute, even of the minutes you might want to miss of my professional life. So that would be where you could find me.
All right, guys, let's go ahead and check out your questions here. Arthur T says, the equality pendulum has swung so far to a near breaking point that it affects all of American life at this point. Do you or Mr. Carl see a feasible path to abolish the CRA and turn the tide against this anti-white ideology? Now, you've already answered, I think, some of this, that the CRA is not sufficient. Let me ask you this as well, since we didn't get to get into it. I had a discussion on Twitter with Chris Rufo, and he suggested that you can't get rid of the CRA, that it actually needs to stay in place to stop anti-white discrimination. I am more skeptical. I believe that as long as the government has the tools to basically review every interpersonal interaction across the United States in perpetuity, it will never be in favor of removing anti-white discrimination. What do you think about the prospect of not just the feasibility, but whether whether we should aim at kind of the removal of this kind of wider leviathan of civil rights legislation?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. And by the way, thank you, Arthur, for your question. So I'm going to be annoying here, and I'm going to split the baby a little bit between you and Rufo, and not just because Chris was kind enough to endorse my book, but because I think there's something in what both of you are saying, in that I am actually not a big fan of talking about repeal. I think it freaks people out because they don't, you know, the average normie person out there is just like, civil rights is a good thing. Are we trying to go back to Jim Crow, which of course we're not, absolutely not trying to do that. I think it's more fundamental and useful to talk about reform. And I think along the lines of what you're talking about, I think this means dramatically reducing the scale of the ways in which this enters our lives, and to kind of just reorient and rethink and understand that, I don't even find it that useful to relitigate the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Again, this is a slight area of departure between me and somebody like Kanani or Caldwell. It was obviously a very blunt instrument. There was real discrimination going on at the time. I think it was reasonably justifiable to use a blunt instrument in good faith. I'm not saying that it would have been my choice to have done it that way, but I'm not going to kind of like just play, backseat driver and say, oh, well, it was bad. I think that the bigger point is, in 2024, we are as far away in time from that as they were from the Wright brothers. We have a totally different set of issues that we're dealing with. We're not worrying about Black people not being served at lunch counters. We're worried about, you know, really dubious racial discrimination suits, not being able to put criminals in prison because of racial disparate impact theory or all sorts of other things. So let's kind of reorient whatever civil rights laws we decide to end up with toward a sort of actual problems that we have today, which are not the kind of problems we had in the early 1960s. And so, look, that's going to be a fight. I think your questioner is right to say, wow, that, you know, implicitly that's a really heavy lift. I think it is, but we have to put it on the table. And until we put it on the table, which I'm trying to do in this book, and other people have also to some degree tried to do, then we're certainly not going to make any real progress on the issue.
Absolutely. Creeper Weirdo says, I heard from some that you wanted to call the book It's Okay to Be White, but the publisher won't let you. It is okay to be white, by the way. Yeah, and Jeremy covered that there. Yeah, not surprising, unfortunately, that they had you pivot away from that. But I think your current title was on
there. I mean, it would have sold so many copies, but it would have made it. It would have made me like even more infamous, and perhaps they were trying to protect me a little bit in giving it this more academic title, protected classes, of course, being a technical term in civil rights law. So it sort of feels less threatening to people who are inclined to be threatened.
It would be a little harder to hand to your grandma.
Right.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, as ridiculous as the fact that that phrase is polarizing, that would have made it a little, put it a little closer to the polemic style.
Right.
Let's see here. Tiny Stupid Demon says, I'm still waiting to see the slightest dent in the regime dogma that all statistical discrepancies between groups are due to racism. That seems necessary. Any thoughts on how that might happen?
Well, I think people are talking about it, and that's the best thing that you can do. And look, I mean, there are profound taboos about going into some areas of this discussion, just as much, if not even greater than some of the taboos of just raising the issues I am. I think kind of regardless of sort of, you know, before I kind of go in personally, this is just, I'm just giving you my personal strategy right now. I'm not trying to tell anybody else what they can do, what they should do, or I'm not trying to punch right on any of this stuff. I would say that, you know, when you begin talking about some of the edgier stuff in this, like, is there a political path through that? I'm not sure that there is a great one. And what I prefer to just really do is, I'm trying to lay out, look, there could be a million different reasons that you have disparities, okay? They could be genetic, environmental, some combination thereof. It could be because the lunar eclipse is, you know, happened in 2024 on a certain day and it just changed the vibes. Like, I don't care what these are to some degree. All I'm trying to prove in this is that it's not, these discrepancies are not a result of white people being racist. And in fact, we've got the exact opposite problem. And so if you will just agree with me on that, okay, then we can all have sort of interesting discussions and disagreements about kind of what you do as step number two. But like right now, what we need to do is blow up the thing that is the absolute myth. And then that hopefully gives us some space to have different and better and more real types of conversations about some of these other issues.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I'm trying to phrase this properly without triggering YouTube. In the 2015s, a lot of people showed up on the scene to declare all of the scientific data that they were very sure about that would like crack this case wide open. And guess what happened? Nothing. Nothing right. happened. No situation improved. The light of day being shown on statistics did not shift the opinion of almost anyone. It did not make any significant changes in law or culture. And that doesn't say that you need to avoid statistics or any truth here. I'm not here to tell you not to tell those truths or not to observe those truths or, you know, make any factual claims. What I'm saying is that should teach you an important lesson about persuasion. And if you cannot observe that lesson, then get your autism checked. Okay.
That's I think you've hit it, right? Like it is truly online autism, right?
Right.
To think otherwise. And you can think that that's fair or you can think that's not fair, but that's just what it is. And I think, Oren, you've hit on it perfectly. It's to look at that recent history, to understand this is about persuasion, to understand that really we can get a large degree of where we want to go if we can prove what is not going on here, which is like white people being racist. Like if we can just establish that. And there's a lot of other things where discrepancies don't need to be adjudicated, the reasons for them down to the seventh decimal place, right? Yes. We can just acknowledge that, hey, there are discrepancies. There are going to be various reasons for those discrepancies, but we're going to do everything we can to observe equality under the law and not kind of play racial games in kind of how we do things in America.
Cooper Weirdo here says, Oren, none of this will make Elon Musk king of the U.S. It's not fast enough for me. You guys are just engaging in Paw Patrol politics. I want it now. Thank you for channeling Curtis Yarvin for us, Cooper Weirdo. You needed a few more ums, though. I don't feel like there are enough breaks in that. And then Davisar says, on this topic of race swapping media like Hamilton, you support Ryan Gosling as Black Panther. Yes, I refuse to really watch very many Marvel movies anymore at this point. But if they made that one, I would go. I would happily hand my money over to the otherwise evil Disney Corp, if only to see the Ryan Gosling Black Panther.
And I do talk about Black Panther and the ideology of Black Panther in this book, in the Hollywood chapter. I think it's interesting. But to kind of get to the very serious kind of point underneath your question, or sort of impish question, no, of course not, right? Like, you would never, you're not, you know, that kind of racial, like, we can have a Black Mary Queen of Scots, but we could never have Ryan Gosling as Black Panther. And of course, we couldn't even have Ryan Gosling as Booker T. Washington or George Washington Carver, or, you know, pick your African-American history.
I feel like it's good Malcolm X. I think that's a
right. Or Ryan Malcolm. You just couldn't do it. And the fact that that door today only swings one way, again, tells us something about where we are in the culture.
Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, it's blindingly obvious, but I am very glad that, again, you took the time and had the courage to put that together in a book that is, I think, well-researched and level-headed. And again, most importantly, probably on this issue, something you can hand to the average person and have them see a well-reasoned case that doesn't blow out any, you know, any gaskets, and otherwise just presents them with something that I think is undeniable in the face of the evidence. All right, guys. Well, like I said, please make sure that you go ahead and order Jerry McCarl's book. And of course, if it's your first time on this channel, make sure that you go ahead and subscribe. Make sure that you go ahead and turn on the notifications, click the bell, make sure that you can catch these streams when they go live. Of course, if you'd like to get these broadcasts as podcasts, make sure that you go ahead and subscribe to the Orrin McIntyre Show on your favorite podcast platform. And when you do, leave a rating or review, it helps with the algorithm. And if you'd like to order my upcoming book, The Total State, you can go ahead and do that on Amazon as well. Thank you for watching, guys. And as always, I will talk to you next time.